Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Bob Lewis. I'm chair of the Canadian Journalism Foundation, and I want to thank you for coming. I also want to extend a special welcome to those who are watching in the TMX studio next door. Our hashtag tonight is CJFJTalk, and you can tweet your questions that way. And please join us later for the reception, which will take place in this room. The turnout tonight, I think, indicates the level of interest and concern so many of us have about journalism in the age of disruption, especially in our daily newspapers. We're worried. We see with our own eyes the departure of respected bylines from newspapers. We see the page counts going down along with the revenues. We see the blurring of lines between editorial and advertising. We see the valiant efforts to seek alternative sources of revenue. And we see the struggle to make the digital equation work. At every turn, journalism is beset by disruptive forces that are hitting us in every business across the world. That's why we're delighted tonight to hear from generals on the front lines, senior leaders who are fighting the good fight against disruption. Before introducing our moderator, I want to thank some good friends of CJFJ Talk, BMO Financial Group, which is the sponsor of this year-long series, Waste Management for supporting our reception, and CPAC for being here and amplifying our message across the country. Now, for our moderator. If you want to stay on top of journalism in the digital age, you need to subscribe to the Nieman Lab. And its founder and guiding light is Josh Benton. He's an optimist who is convinced that journalism can adapt to the internet age. He was a Nieman Fellow himself in 2008. Before that, he was an investigative reporter, a columnist, a foreign correspondent, and a rock critic, having worked at the Dallas Morning News and the Toledo Blade. He's a Yale grad with a wide variety of interests, including maintaining his French language blog, Josh en Français, as he puts it, pour pratiquer et améliorer ma langue ancestrale. So I give you the dental Cajun, the Cajun, Josh Benton.
Thank you. That reminds me, I need to update that. It's been a while since I've updated Josh en Français. Thank you so much for the introduction, and it's a great pleasure to be back here at a CJF event. It's been a couple years. I am from the United States, but I am a great Canadaphile. It's actually a point of mockery among all my employees over, how much I enjoy talking about Canada. I won't use my party trick of reciting all the Canadian prime ministers in reverse chronological order. I usually end up screwing up around the 20s or so. But it's a great pleasure to be here. And we're going to be talking a lot about these issues of disruption. And really, one way to think about it is whether or not to frame it as a fight against disruption, or whether it's a way to take the engine of disruption and try to figure out ways to benefit from it or to work with it. Because in a lot of ways, the forces that are affecting the newspaper industry in the United States and in Canada are larger than what any one institution can deal with. Very quickly, I want to introduce our four panelists. These are four men who represent four of the great newspaper companies of Canada, who in some way have a significant influence over a lot of the media that you consume. Starting on the far end, we have Jerry Knott, who is the Senior Vice President for the Eastern Region for Post Media, until quite recently the editor and publisher of the Ottawa Citizen. Next to him, we have Andre Pratt, the editorial page editor at La Presse, which has a very different model that we'll be talking about a little bit later. Next to him is Philip Crawley, the publisher and CEO of the Globe and Mail. And right next to me, John Cruikshank, the publisher of the Toronto Star. Just think of all the home deliveries that these people are responsible for. It's a large number. We are going to range over many issues in the next hour or so up here, and then about a half hour or so for questions from you folks. But I want to start off with the issue that in some ways drives the career that we all entered when we started in newspapers, back when they were newspapers, and that was very much the product at hand, print and print advertising. We mostly study the United States at Nieman Lab, and the numbers for print advertising there are frankly terrifying. In 2006, American newspapers in print generated around $50 billion in advertising revenue. The numbers for 2013 aren't out yet, but they'll be around $16 billion. That's 50 to 16 in a matter of about 7 years. It's still dropping in the United States at the rate of somewhere in the high single digits, 7 to 9%, depending on the newspaper group. And another way to think about it is that Kleiner Perkins, Mary Meeker pulled this statistic together. I thought it was really remarkable. Try to think of one way to conceive of advertising is comparing the amount of time people spend in a form of media and the amount of advertising revenue that goes towards that media. So, for example, in the United States, 43% of media consumption is on television. That's what 40% of the time we spend consuming media is spent watching television. And 42% of the advertising dollars go to television. It's fairly balanced. For print, newspapers and magazines, 6% of our media consumption time in the United States now is done in print. But 23% of advertising dollars still go there. And you can look at that and say, that's wonderful, or you can look at it and say, wow, that's going to go away. I want to just start by throwing something out to each of you to ask, is there any reason to think that print advertising is ever going to grow again? Do you have any hope that whatever dollar amount that you're making now, at any point there will be a larger dollar amount for print advertising?
Well, we certainly don't. I mean, we came to the conclusion quite early, I'd say 3 years ago at least, that the business model of the newspaper was broken, and that it was beyond repair. And that even though we thought at a point that the internet could save us, and we, like many other newspapers, built up a great internet site with all kinds of stuff in it, free, but we rapidly realized that even though our site at least was extremely popular, from a revenue standpoint, it just didn't work. And we'll talk about our project later, but I think this was really the starting point. Not that newspapers are finished or that the written word as a media is finished, but that obviously would take a very radical change rather than trying to find a way to save the model that we have now. That model, we firmly believe, is beyond repair.
I know that the most recent numbers from the Toronto Star were that advertising revenue was down 9% year over year in the most recent quarter, Post Media 12% in the most recent quarter. These are rates of decline even faster than what we're seeing in the United States. Do you feel similarly that print advertising is essentially a lost cause?
We are later in the cycle, if we are in the same cycle, than the States. And in fact, if you look at the declines over time, we seem to be a couple of years behind what's happened in the States. So our numbers are a little larger now, although on the whole we've done better. And that's because the media landscape overall is a little bit different in Canada. I think it's important to think about audiences rather than advertising dollars, because advertising dollars are the consequence of audiences. And I think the real question is are we able to create new audiences, desirable audiences that are desirable for advertisers in print? And the answer to that is yes, in some forms, and not in others. The old paid Metropolitan Daily is not going to have that kind of success. We've had real success in growing advertising revenue with the Metro papers across the country. They're not anybody's editorial preference, but they're serving a really important function, an educative function, for some folks, many of whom were not newspaper readers before. So there is a revenue influx there. I would say that the model is not dumbed down. The model is niche, because there may be niches in print where you can still earn money.
How about at Postmedia? You have both the national paper and lots of metros. How do you see the print advertising market?
Well, I think we would certainly celebrate single-digit decline. The 12, the 12 kind of stands out a little bit. I appreciate, too, that we're sometimes open to criticism when we say, well, we don't really sell print, we sell audience. And in fact, we do sell audience, and you know that we didn't used to talk like that. But I think we don't anticipate that coming back. On the revenue side, I think that there is some belief that if we can get the audience piece right and very narrowly and precisely define who the print audience is, we may be able to affect that decline in a positive way and either slow it down or stabilize it so that we're delivering the exact audience, that a print advertiser would want.
At the Globe a few years ago with the redesign, there was an emphasis on what at the time was called a proudly print approach. investing a lot of money, $1.7 billion over 18 years in a new printing deal for higher quality paper, higher quality stock. Looking back, having seen what has happened to print advertising, does that seem like the correct strategic decision still for you?
Not my money, by the way, not $1.7 billion of Globe money. That's what it's worth to Transcontinental to print the Globe until 2028. Yes, absolutely was it worth doing. It's given us a competitive edge that we would not have had. We've gained a lot of new advertisers that we didn't have before 2010 because we can offer magazine quality printing in a newspaper, and it continues to attract. So do I think that print advertising is ever going to get back to 1998 levels? Of course it isn't. Do I think there are areas of growth that we can exploit? Absolutely. And thank God for disruption. I wouldn't have said it in 1998, but thank God for Conrad Black being foolish enough to launch the National Post. We needed that to happen to disrupt the complacency of the Globe and Mail at the time. We need disruption to keep on moving us forward. The pace of disruption is increasing. And as far as I'm concerned, that's a good thing. We need to keep reinventing the business model. The way we did it 5 years ago, 10 years ago, not good enough.
I don't know all the details of the printing arrangement, but one thing that struck me when it was announced a few years ago was the idea of making any sort of contract for print for that long a period of time seemed odd to me, since it seemed that to be able to predict with any sort of confidence what anyone's printing needs will be in 2020 or whatever seemed unusual. Is that a vote of confidence that the Globe will be a print product, you know, on the same number of days that it is today, you know, 10 years from now?
Yeah, I would be expecting to print the Globe 6 days a week in 10 years' time. The demographics of our readership are such that there's a very strong desire to keep on with that choice. They want a choice. They want to be able to access print, access on a tablet, access on a whatever device they're using. But they don't want, in my view, what La Presse is trying to do, which is take print away.
I'm glad you two are sitting next to each other. It would be good.
La Presse are having a hard time persuading their print readers to stop reading. I mean, if you look at what they're doing in terms of marketing, they're saying, please stop reading the paper. Please stop spending the money on buying the paper. We're giving you this tablet for free. And how many copies have actually dropped? Not very many. So the familiarity, the habitual use of print, yeah, I don't have to tell you how many complaints we get, you know, at 6 o'clock in the morning if the paper doesn't arrive on the doorstep, even though it's snowing like hell outside, expect the paper there. There's still a very strong desire for that, and I don't see that going away anytime soon.
Great. We will get to the La Presse model in a second, but I did want to ask, let you say.
I just want to make the point that there's nothing mysterious whatever about the decline of newspapers. It's really been it's been steady, frankly, you know, since the advent of television, and we can predict out now based on the audiences we have just how long the runway is.
Well, the circulation decline has been going on since the advent of television, but advertising decline is an entirely different curve.
Well, except it's completely related because it's related to the average age of the audience. It really is about audiences. But the other point to make, it seems to me, is that in North America, we became accustomed to a revenue split of 75% to 80% advertising and, you know, 25% to 30% from consumers. That was never the case in Europe and in many other jurisdictions, where it was much more likely to be 50-50. So in a lot of places, we're getting closer to 50-50, and we're thinking about revenue in very, very different ways, mm-hmm. And certainly thinking about costs in very different ways. If we pursue that and acknowledge that there's not simply one model, because that model is gone, then I think we have a lot more freedom to think positively about what we can do for the future.
So I want to ask for Postmedia and The Star on the question of continuing to print as many days as you do now. In the United States, the Advance Publications newspaper chain, which runs in houses papers in New Orleans and Cleveland and Portland, has shifted away from 7-day print to 3 to 4 day print, depending on the city. I think it's fair to say, it's certainly true in the United States, I assume it's true here, that no one makes any money on the Monday paper. It's not the place where the revenues are. Do either of you foresee in 3 years' time, 5 years' time, a less frequent publication in print?
I mean, as you know, I think most folks here would know the Post hasn't published on Mondays in the summer now, probably right. three or 4 years. Certainly when we took our Sunday papers out of the markets in Edmonton, Calgary, and Ottawa, we saw a circulation decline because we broke the reading habit. So that looking at those days in isolation might have some appeal at the outset, but you need to look at the impact of a reading habit. And I think in Ottawa, I think we took about a 4% circ decline following much of it attributable, we felt, to the Sunday decision. I don't see it happening in the metro markets in Postmedia 3 to 5 years out. It's possible, depends on the acceleration or how we deal with the disruption, but certainly not in that time frame, Josh. I don't see that.
And I think the whole notion that it's not important that you turn up one day that's antithetical to how we think about what we do. You know, the idea that, well, you don't need the paper, you know. Well, if you don't need it on Sunday, or you don't need it on Monday, why don't you need it on Tuesday? Why don't you need it on Wednesday? We actually do believe that it's important you get your paper every day, because we think it's vital to how you function as a citizen in your community.
Let me
regret if you're not a subscriber.
Well, I'm sorry I don't subscribe.
I regret it too. I can get you a digital sub like that.
I will admit there are a few times when I was really just soaking up Rob Ford stories when I would hit that paywall and thought, man, oh well, guess I'll go to the Globe now. But just to play devil's advocate, it goes beyond devil's advocate. I think there's more than a little bit of truth to it, I would argue. We kind of know how the print story is going to end, don't we? We know that advertising dollars are going to continue to decline on an annual basis. We know that circulation in print is going to continue to decline. We know that the home delivery subscribers are going to continue to age. Maybe 3 to 5 years is one span of time, but I think, I'm curious if this is true, but 50 years from now, I doubt it, anyone thinks there's going to be a 7-day print product or a 6-day print product. I could be wrong about that. Or at the very least, that would be a primary driver of your revenues. Is there any sense that by not being willing to run away from print, and this is where we're going to get to you in a second, that you might be over-investing in what you know is the declining part of your business and not taking out the opportunities that you might have to invest in where the area of growth is going to be?
I mean, I think there's a way to manage that, and you have to manage the transition. I mean, we talk about the demographics of our readership. We know if they believe in the brand and we maintain a certain quality that over time, if print does 10, 12, 15, whatever that number, 20 is, that is, if our brand promise remains high quality journalism, then logically thinking that demographic as it should follow us into the digital world. But how fast, I don't know that.
We invest in news and we're profitable in print. Why would we run away from that?
All right. Since we've talked a bit around it, I want to get directly to the La Presse model, because I imagine there are a lot of people in English-speaking Canada who aren't that familiar with it. Maybe could you just give maybe a 2 or 3 minute summary of the decision that was made and how the shift into digital and in specific towards a tablet approach has worked?
Yeah. Okay. First of all, I must say that the person who should have been here is Guy Crevier, our publisher, who's really the driving force behind this, but unfortunately, he's so busy traveling the world trying to explain what the hell we're trying to do that he couldn't be here tonight. But it's very difficult to explain what our new platform, what we call our new media is. So I would just suggest that you go in the App Store and download the La Presse Plus app, because it's very different from what you've seen anywhere else. And it's extremely difficult to explain exactly what it is. But still, it's a digital newspaper, but that we started from scratch. You mentioned the ritual, which has been decades old, of people in the morning opening their door and taking their newspaper and so on. But we looked at this. We looked at our revenues going down. Our readership on paper actually, in our case, was not going down. It was stable. But we saw that our readership was growing older, and we had a lot of difficulty attracting younger readers. And when we looked at how young people get their news today, and I mean 35 and under or 40 and under, first of all, most of them get it free. So it's very difficult for in our market. We're not saying that we're an example for other markets, but in our market, even though we are a very high quality newspaper and that people love our columnists and so on, it was difficult to see a scenario where people would continue paying for our newspaper or paying into a paywall to get their news, because they could get it free in many other places, Radio-Canada being one great example and a competitor for us. So that's number one. Second, we saw the tablet penetration faster than any other, either iPhones or whatever. The tablet has a very high and rapid market penetration. And when we look at the newspaper, there is a very strong ritual of people getting their newspaper in the morning, but people are also now want their news and their columnists and their recipes for cooking and so on. They want it 24 hours a day, each minute. That's the new ritual. So how long? We thought that there was a very high risk if we decided to simply maintain the same ritual, because people now want to read. And that's been very strong, coming very strong out of our many focus groups preparing for that project. But they also want video, and they want to be able to interact, not only with their news stories, but with the advertisements and so on. You know, they want to interact. And all this a newspaper cannot do and will never be able to do. However you increase the quality of printing, it's not interactive. So that's really the basis of our choices. We decided to look at a tablet and see if we started from scratch today, a new media, to fit the advantages of that platform, how would we do it?
And one thing that was interesting about that choice is that the La Presse Plus is still delivered as an issue once a day in the morning, which is sort of an opposing point of view to the ever constant flow and stream of news and information on the web. I'm curious why your organization thought that once a day issue-based, you know, if President Obama is shot at noon.
No, but you always have, you know, access to, what is it, and a very nice characteristic of this model is that you do get your newspaper, La Presse Plus, in the morning, at 5 in the morning, wherever you are in the world. When you open it, you always have access, instant access, to the web, if you're connected, obviously, so that the instant news is always there every time you're connected. That's number one. But there is a very strong ritual. But the ritual is changing also, because, for instance, when we look at how people read our La Presse Plus, and by the way, the app has been downloaded now nearly 400,000 different tablets, which is quite incredible for a French newspaper. And we have now about 120,000 daily readers, which is about 60% of our daily circulation in the newspaper. So that's quite a success in less than a year. And we see that people spend about 35 minutes each day, but a big part of that is now during the evening, which is something people rarely did and is interesting for the advertisers. People tend to look at the news in the morning in their newspaper and the comments on politics and so on, and they look at the at night, they read more the,
sure,
you know, cooking and restaurants and so on. So it's a new habit, it's a new ritual,
right,
that's been created.
I want to ask the rest of the panel your thoughts on the La Presse model, but also more broadly about tablets as a vector for publication distribution on its own, separate from the La Presse model, in part because we saw so much energy around 2010, 2011 around the iPad. So many magazines decided they were going to invest a lot of money into building iPad editions. They thought that was going to be the way they could sort of recapture the channel of content that they had lost on the wide open web. And for the most part, they have been disappointments financially. And just yesterday, Trinity Mirror in the UK decided to kill its tablet project. And there's been some of the optimism that used to exist, I'm not sure exists in the same way. I'm curious, as folks who have not dedicated to the tablet as a specific distribution channel, but nonetheless, your content is read on tablets. How do you think about it?
Should I leave for this part, or can I?
Well, I'd like an answer from La Presse on how they're going to influence politics in Quebec. The Desmarais family, with their tradition of supporting a particular political point of view in Quebec. You've got Pierre-Carl Péladeau potentially wanting to run for premier of Quebec. If that were to happen, how influential would La Presse be on a tablet as opposed to having the power of the print medium to argue their case against what he would be trying to do? Because obviously PKP's got lots of media to apply to his cause if he wishes to do that. So I'd be interested to hear what degree of political power you think you might exercise through a once-a-day tablet delivery and a smaller website.
Well, first of all, as a chief editorial writer, I already see that we don't have that much influence in what's going on. Certainly not these days. But
it's good to see editorial writers honest with themselves. That's a good thing.
Well, if you look at the Québécois on Québécois side and ours, if we had decided to stay simply in the print model, we never would have had PKP's influence because he's got television. We don't have television. We don't. You know, there's no way we're going to invest that kind of money in television. So, and you seem to take for granted that our newspaper operations will simply disappear one day. And in a way, we think it's probable, but the market will decide that. I mean, if readers remain very attached to the newspaper, it will remain for maybe much longer than we thought. But we also know that we have a lot of new readers on the tablet, and we believe that our influence is increasing because of that. We have a younger readership, much more engaged than young readers with the newspaper. So I would bet that our influence will increase rather than decrease.
But your business model doesn't work if you're still paying for the print legacy cost and you've also got an expensive tablet product, because your tablet is a beautiful product.
But thank you.
But it is not.
Did you just stop there?
But it is not a cheap product.
It is not. It is not.
You've spent a lot of money getting to where you've got, and it's labor intensive. You've got a lot of people involved in it. And you know, that's an additional heavy cost, so you're paying both those costs. Can you do that?
Well, we've also decreased cost considerably, both for the printing plant, Transcontinental, and our delivery costs have been reduced considerably. And we're trying to make this a very agile operation, you know, where we've invested a lot, but we're also now trying to reduce, we're reducing the cost. We invested a lot because we were creating a new product, and we're getting revenues now out of this new product. If we had decided not to do anything, we would lose money. So, I mean, and our influence would decrease because we would not be able to produce as great content as we do now. So
I would like to move on to a couple other subjects, but I know that both folks on both of our ends would like to make a brief comment about tablets.
just quickly, I mean, first of all, the status quo is not an option, and La Presse is done its gamble, and more power to them. Post-media, we're doing something a little bit different. In the spring, we're going to relaunch the Ottawa Citizen on 4 platforms, on print, web, smartphone, and tablet. Each with its very specific targeted audience based on who we know uses those products. The tablet product will be a part of that, and it'll be a different product, very different than La Presse. It's going to be an evening, daily evening publication. But I think the point is that we think that there is a play there. We think that the technology offers us an opportunity to tell stories in a very, very different way, and there's an audience for it. Perhaps not on its own without some very serious consideration of what you're going to do on the other platforms to capture the entire audience you want.
Right, and at the start.
Well, I want to first say that I think La Presse has done an extraordinary job and been incredibly brave to do what they've done. And their circumstances may be sufficiently different in Quebec from what the kind of environment that we're in, that you can entirely justify that while deciding you want to do something quite different in this world. I like Jerry, think that different technologies choose different audiences. And then you can further refine that with the kind of news agenda that you bring to it, and the kind of formats and approaches that you have. And that's really what excites us. We've spent a lot of time, we've got a print product we think works very, very well to achieve the kind of influence we want and the kind of impact we want and to achieve profitability. But we have put an enormous amount of attention and engagement into thinking as news people rather than as print people and trying to begin to plumb the opportunities to connect with new audiences, different audiences, lost audiences, on different platforms. So we wouldn't want to give up any opportunity on any platform. And also, we're not sure that the tablet is really the terminus of technology. There may be something beyond it.
All right, well, we'll see about that.
I might just make a point, because I
very
think,
brief.
John, there is one, I think, specific aspect, at least in our market, is that a paywall does not work and will not work. I mean, La Presse is a general family newspaper. We have very good content that our readers love, but many of our readers would not pay more for it, and our advertisers are leaving us. And a paywall on our website, even though our website is extremely popular, would simply not work.
What a beautiful transition to talking about paywalls.
It's a case for our market. We're not saying that it's true, and for some news organization, a paywall has some advantages, brings revenues, but not for us.
So the other three news organizations and news companies represented here have adopted paywalls to an extent that La Presse has chosen not to. In the United States now, a majority of daily newspapers have a paywall of some sort or another. In our country, the most successful general interest paywall is, of course, at the New York Times, where they've signed up 700,000 digital subscribers. But even at the Times, what I think it broadly can be described as a paywall success story, still only about 10% of their revenues come from the digital subscription model. The number of digital subscribers has started to plateau. They're not getting the gains that they once were. They still think there's some growth internationally, but they're starting to think that they're running out of the people who are willing to pay that, a standard paywall amount every month. When journalists talk about paywalls and have over the last few years, a lot of times they've talked about it as if it is this moment of salvation, like if only we can get people to pay for our content again, then gosh darn it, all of our problems will go away. But do any of you think that paywalls are anything other than a Band-Aid? It's revenue that's nice to have, but it's not a game changer. The revenue is still a small amount of money in the grand scheme of the economic model of newspapers, right? Or do any of you think differently?
Well, compared to what print advertising still delivers, yes, absolutely, it's small. But we're enormously better informed after 15 months of running a paywall about what our readers like to read and what will persuade them that something is valuable and worth paying for than we were before we started, because we get that data every day now. Our journalists make decisions based on that data. We know what converts people to pay. That's very useful information.
And you're incentivizing editors to create that content by creating a financial incentive for them to do that.
Editorial managers. Depending on which section they're in, there's different targets. But we set targets for traffic, we set targets for video plays, we set targets for how many subscriptions we can convert in the course of a month. And there's a very direct cause and effect. I can tell you that 75% of the subscription conversions that we get are driven by business content. So the Globe and Mail has a very strong business section.
Makes a lot of sense.
That's what works. Mm-hmm. It's not other stuff, it's that.
So are you now dedicating more editorial resources to business as a result of that knowledge?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We're very conscious that that's a competitive area, business journalism. Bloomberg are moving into Canada in a bigger way. Wall Street Journal are moving into Canada in a bigger way. So we're not taking anything for granted. That's the new discipline that exists in the newsroom about what we choose to do every day. So there are groups of people who meet and talk about this at 8 o'clock in the morning, 9 o'clock in the morning. They make choices based on that.
Sure.
I think that's a very good discipline.
I want to get some numbers, since I found it was often difficult to get hard numbers on digital subscription models in Canada. The reporting seems to be more regular in the United States from what I can tell. How many digital-only subscribers does the National Post have, does the Toronto Star have, does the Globe and Mail have?
Okay, so we have 110,000 people who've signed up to Globe Unlimited since we launched 15 months ago.
Which includes print subscribers, so that's not a digital-only.
Half of those are people who are print subscribers, and half of them are digital subscribers.
So 55,000 digital-only subscribers, okay. How about the Post and the Star?
And we'd be at about 137,000 all access, so print and digital, and
that's the Post or the Post Media?
That's Post Media.
Okay.
And in around 45,000 digital.
For all the papers combined?
Yes.
Okay. And how about the Star?
We're still at too early a stage to make numbers public.
I did notice that in November you said that it was too early to tell, and after 6 months we'd have a better sense. 3 weeks from today is 6 months. Right. So I do acknowledge that we are a little bit early, but I don't know what wisdom
Josh,
is going to arrive in the next
time.
21 days. All right. I look forward to calling you back in 22 days. I'll give you the extra to get together the numbers. So you've talked about, you mentioned how the business is what does the conversion that's led to editorial decisions. I'm curious, at either the Star or the Post Media papers, have you seen anything? I assume it's too early to tell for you, but have you seen anything about how a paywall paying reader is different from one who doesn't, or what have you seen in the data that you're able to get, which is of course one of the benefits of a...
Well, first of all, we call them pay meters just because it's a little more delicate, but and I'd encourage you. I think that the original question around, you know, whether we saw pay meters as some kind of a panacea, the answer is no. I think for us, the pay meter is part of a much larger strategy around the four platforms, and you know, for the most part, those pay meters were attached to websites. It's expanded, and again, we come back to the notion that if you have differentiated quality content across the four platforms, then people will pay for it. We've undervalued what we do for a long time. Are we learning lots about our readership from it? Absolutely. Certainly at the Post, we've seen unique page views increase since the pay meter went there, and we think partly it's because the Globe went first, and it probably brought some traffic over to us. So we're not at the point where Philip is with incentivizing editors yet, but you can learn lots and lots about your readership through that pay model.
We were talking earlier about audiences, and I'm curious about how this shift to digital and this shift to digital pay models has changed the way that you might think about your audiences, because of course the people who pay for a digital subscription are a different group of people than the people who read your content online, who are a different group of people from the people who read your content in print. Philip, a few months ago, you were quoted as saying that we don't care about anyone who makes less than $100,000. John Stackhouse later clarified a bit about that $120,000
What am I
going to
say? I was misquoted.
Fair enough. Never trust a journalist, I get that. But nonetheless, I mean, you've always had an upmarket target audience,
yeah.
But both for the Globe and for the other outlets, including La Presse, which has a different shift in how it gets to its audience. How are you thinking about, in some ways this gets to the question of democracy, because of course the mass market newspaper played an important part in how, you know, we learn about our government, we learn about politics, we learn about the decisions that we have to make as part of a democracy. Is there any concern that perhaps by becoming more niche-oriented publications, by trying to move up market demographically, but there might be putting some of that at risk, or how you think about your audience in general?
The lessons we've learned so far is that a audience that pays for multiple access is a far more engaged audience. They come and read more, they spend more time, and the retention factor really improves, and the New York Times has found the same. So for us, after a year or more of stats, we can see something like a 25% improvement in retention. So, you know, that's worth quite a bit of money. It stops having to pay again for renewal. So that is a double win. Mm-hmm. So to get that kind of involvement and engagement, as far as I'm concerned, very positive development. So we like the fact that they're paying for that multiple access.
Anyone else want?
Well, and I can just add maybe one point that we did a lot of research while working on our new media, and one thing we realized is that people want to be in control of their reading experience. They hate it, for instance, when they start a video and there's a 30-second or 15-second commercial. They hate it when some kind of ad pops up, you know, and they're looking for the X to try to make it disappear. And that's the way we built our app. That is that people are always in total control of what's going on. They can look at an ad or not. They can skip it. They can engage with it or not. And the same with the news stories and the videos and so on. And I think that is one aspect of a newspaper where people are in control that has to be maintained in any kind of new platform. People want to be in control of what they're doing. They don't want to have stuff imposed on them.
I think the questions for our democracies are actually far more interesting and probably far more critical than the questions for our media corporations. Most of the time here, we've been talking about a crisis that we, because we're publishers or you know related to the business, a crisis in the business model. Right? There's a different kind of crisis, a social challenge. And that lies in the fact that for a long time, newspapers, we were reliant upon newspapers as the principal investigators of their communities, have ceased to speak to a very broad range of their community. And that's become a progressive problem over many, many years. And it isn't one that's being very successfully addressed by other media. It's one of the reasons why we're so excited at the Star about looking at how we can engage with other audiences, with the new technology that has developed, with the platforms that have developed. But from a broader perspective, a democratic perspective, the real issue is not newspaper decline. The real issue is the decline it's a slope that's not quite so dramatic, but it is as continuous. And that is the decline in people who are interested in news every day. And that's been falling for the same period, you know, about since 1960. You know, a very, very long slide. And that decline also relates absolutely directly to who votes. Right? So the percentage of Canadians, certainly, who go out and vote has been falling as that group has of those who are no longer interested in news every day has been falling, and they've been falling in lockstep.
There is an interesting counter data point to that in the United States, in that the last few presidential elections have seen higher voter turnout than any for the previous several decades, and one of the reasons that gets attributed to is the idea that social media and online activism and politics engages audiences in a way that traditional newspapers might not have. So I guess I'm not as pessimistic about that as
well. You've got two. You've got Obama 1 and Obama 2. And it certainly is. And remember, before that, it's 1960. It's Kennedy. It began to fall after Kennedy's election in 60. And every election after that, you saw a dramatic decline in cohorts. And yes, you see a tiny bump. And I haven't looked at Obama 2, but in Obama 1, you get a tiny bump back up. But it's against a trend line that's gone like that. It's not like you've gone back up to 1960 numbers. Right, you've gone back up to 2011 numbers, right, or 2000?
Not quite.
Whatever,
it's,
right?
It's a bigger game than that.
It goes to the whole issue of are we going to recreate those elements of community that we see, you know, having been eroded over a long period with social media.
Right.
And I mean, it's an interesting and very long discussion.
Sure. I do want to ask, since you know the traditional newspaper business model. On our continent, at least, was two legs of the stool, that advertising, circulation. Luckily, you know, two-legged stools rarely do well, but these were very strong legs, so it worked out just fine. We've added, you know, some digital advertising money and now some digital circulation money. I want to just ask very briefly, what is the new revenue source that you're most optimistic about going forward? I'm thinking of things like video advertising, which has traditionally been quite small, but is growing. Native advertising in the United States, marketing services is a big growth area. What do you see as something that could potentially become another anchor to the new newspaper business model going forward?
I think for us, the one that has the most potential, certainly video for sure. We've taken a swing at video and missed. I think it was three
like
years ago
newspapers.
We sent out 300 flip cameras to our newsrooms that most of them are still sitting in boxes. So we're take another run at that.
You can but send them back to flip. Oh wait, they're out of business. Sorry.
Exactly. I think mobile presents the biggest opportunity, and if we can figure out what the ad serving on that platform is probably where the most upside. You know, I think we're seeing about 58% of our traffic is coming from mobile devices.
58%.
58.
Those are absurdly high numbers.
42 desktop, laptop. So there is, and when you talked about that indexing about where the advertising dollars go, it's somewhere under 2%. So there's an enormous opportunity if we can figure that out.
Is anyone else seeing 52% mobile? Because in the United States, you've seen some newspapers that are getting up to 40, but yeah. 50 plus is.
We saw it at the Vancouver Sun in November 2012 with the Amanda Todd story. I mean, most people here would be familiar with it. And since then, every one of our markets is in the same place.
Interesting. Other revenue?
Our figures for mobile are much higher in BC than they are elsewhere. So there does seem to be an adoption rate there, which is higher than the average. But 40-odd% is about our level, and obviously it depends on the day.
Mm-hmm. But in answer to your revenue, we're toying with this, you know, the centripetal model, right? 100 feet. I think we've got to be open to thinking about revenue streams from a lot of different places.
So is there one in particular that
no, and
you're
see
saying?
That, and that's the point. And you know, there's this great, you know, excitement around the tablet was going to save us all, and then, you know, well, as it turned out, it didn't. Paywalls were going to save us all. Well, it turns out they haven't. It's I think that whole salvationist mentality is probably.
I'm not asking salvation. Like, what's going to give you 10% of your revenue? Is video going to be the answer?
I mean, what we've found on the CERC side that we've been able to drive very significant revenue increases with print products, with new or improved print products that we distribute with the newspaper. There are ways of changing the business model. And you just have to be very aggressive in pursuing them.
So let me talk about us. You know, we don't write about success in our industry very often. We're very good at writing about lack of success in our industry, and Americans are particularly good at writing about lack of success because you've got more lack of success than any other country in the world.
To brag about.
Cheers to us.
You are the poster boys for lack of success in newspapers.
Well done, Trash.
It's all me.
The Daily Telegraph is about to report its third year of profit growth this year. According to The Guardian, who are fascinated by The Telegraph because they're so jealous, The Telegraph Group will make about £60 million profit. Third year in a row of profit growth. They've adopted some new revenue streams. You know, they're into staging conferences and boat shows.
Selling wine.
Cruises, right? E-commerce is now 11% of their total revenue. And this is a very, on the face of it, staid, conservative British newspaper. How annoying for The Guardian, with all their glamorous investigations and the genius of Mr. Rusbridger and all of that, that they lose 30-odd million a year. And they can't monetize that vast traffic that they get successfully. So, you know, interesting, same market. One's making 60 million, one's losing 30-odd, 40 million a year. Mm. They've just sold Audit Trader, 600 million, cashing in on their asset to help pay The Guardian's bills.
When I was preparing for tonight, I emailed 15 or so Canadian journalists who I know to ask if they had any thoughts on issues to bring up. And one of the consistent thoughts that they had was that they were disappointed that Canadian journalism did not seem to have the same sort of startup culture or entrepreneurial spirit that they see in the United States, that there are not nearly as many new digital native web-born startups that are trying to compete for attention, that there are many, we have in the United States hundreds and hundreds of hyper-local startups. We have dozens and dozens of nonprofit investigative news organizations, plenty of vertical-based pure plays, many, many outlets. It doesn't seem, that there are a few examples that always come up when we talk about Canada. It doesn't seem like there are nearly as many. I'm curious why you think, whether you would agree with that characterization, and if so, why you think that would be, other than the obvious market size issue, which is the clearest. But do you think that's an accurate perception? I've heard it from many Canadian journalists over the last few years.
I mean, I think it's generally accurate, my own sense of it. I mean, I can think of some open file tried to get started. We partnered with them in Ottawa for a while and didn't get very far. We worked with a college there on a model of entrepreneurial journalism that didn't go very far. I think one quick thought is that I'm not sure the journalism schools here foster it to the degree that the American schools do. And that's a broad brushstroke, and I don't intend to offend, but I think that might be one place to look.
What does it look like in Quebec?
Well, Quebec is a small market.
Sure.
And, if you start some kind of small news organization, very local in a city like New York, and you grab a 0.01% of the market, I mean, you get a big market. If you do the same in Montreal or Quebec City, you can't survive. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one main aspect, and it's true. I think reporters, even the younger generation, at least in Quebec, they're brilliant. They usually studied abroad, speak many languages, but they're not entrepreneurs in any other, it's just not in their culture. They're more to the left. They like investigative reporting, but if they can get a good salary, they like that even better.
And I think the young Quebecers are more entrepreneurial than the young non-Quebecers in Canada. There is an issue in the culture, but the other thing that's certainly true is it's very difficult for organizations like ours to seed those smaller ventures because they get infected so quickly with our cost structures and it crushes them.
What's interesting is from what I've seen in the smaller countries in Europe that have a similar sort of smaller market issue and they don't have a lot of startups, it seems that those are some of the countries where the established news organization, news companies, have been able to start Craigslist before Craigslist comes in and to take advantage of some of the online business opportunities, often not news related, but business opportunities that can generate revenue. And it almost seems like their establishment position has helped them. They've been able to take advantage of that.
How many non-Norwegian players compete
in
Norwegian?
And so, right?
I mean, this is
Norwegian.
Quite,
not many at all.
I mean, this is really the issue.
Yeah.
It's if you're in an English market, then you're competing with everybody else working in English.
Is there any sense though that when I worked at the Toledo Blade, I always listened to CIMX Radio 89X in Windsor, and that meant that I listened to, because it was the 90s, I listened to a lot of Sloan and Super Friends and Jail and things like that. And that was specific. The only reason that was the case because CanCon regulations meant that those radio stations were playing those songs and those artists, and I still go to Sloan shows today, as scary as that is. Now, is there any sense that when the Huffington Post is more than happy to move into Canada, they're more than happy to try and take it, and I'm sure there are lots of other outlets that feel similarly coming from the United States. Is there I don't want to say a cultural protectionist sense, but is there a sense that there might be a role to play to make sure that these entities, that Canadian online media is Canadian online media and not a watered-down version of American online media? Not to get all imperialist on you, but...
I would dread to think that Canada could become any more protectionist than it already is.
It's
bred deep in the bone, and it's media, it's telecoms, it's banks. We don't need any more, thank you.
I don't think we object to HuffPo. HuffPo is actually hiring young reporters in the country and doing kind of a nice job of developing a news, a local news culture. The issue for us is not U.S. news outlets. It's Google and Facebook.
Which, of course, control, I mean, in the United States at least, 70% of the digital advertising market is controlled by six companies, and Google and Facebook control about 40 to 50% of that. So.
Yeah, and we're just completely integrated into that market. And
sure.
So, you know, they've taken, I mean, most of the transfer of advertising dollars that have gone out of Canadian newspapers have wound up in you know, the pockets of Google and Facebook, not other American media, news media.
That's an aspect that I, at least the feeling I have, is that we don't really master yet the impact of the social media for news. During the student strike in Quebec last year, I mean, there were La Presse in particular was criticized a lot by the young people for our coverage. And after this, and it was a very emotional period for journalists, and because they were attacked during demonstrations by students who thought that we defended the universities and the government. And after the strike, we had our research department look at how young people got their information. And of course, young people were very much interested. So at this period, at least, young Quebecers read a lot of what was going on. And we realized that they did not get their information from news sites or newspapers or television, and not even Twitter. They got it from Facebook. They got it from their friends who told them there's a demonstration there, or look at what La Presse wrote, or look at, you know, Facebook was their source. And I think that's a huge challenge for all news organizations. That is, you know, people will read us, maybe they will continue reading us, but through Facebook and not through our own sites or apps or.
We're almost out of time for this section before we get to the questions from the audience. If you have a question, now is a very good time to tweet it, because that's the things one does in the 21st century. Hashtag CJFJTalk. One last question I want to just ask. I get questioned a lot, and I'm sure all of you do as well, from young journalists, university students, high school students who are interested in a career in journalism. In a lot of ways, today's 18-year-old or 22-year-old has spent their entire, you know, life creating media in a way that encourages a lot of them to want to be interested in journalism. A few years ago, when people would ask me advice, you know, the newspaper decline in the United States was such that it was kind of hard to recommend a lot of things. But in the last 3 years or so, the online media industry in the United States has grown up so much, there's so many opportunities that I feel pretty good talking to these young people and saying there are going to be opportunities available to you. I'm just curious, given that it's, you know, it's a little bit different in Canada, as you said, two or three years behind perhaps. What sort of advice would you give to someone about their, you know, legitimate advice about career prospects for someone who is interested in entering the journalism business right now? Just if we could just quickly go through.
I would share your enthusiasm, to be honest with you. I think the opportunity, as this industry reinvents itself, the need for 22-year-old people coming out of school, not print native and digital native, is fantastic. And I know, as we've gone through a series of, you know, difficult cuts at Post Media over the years, the one thing we have always been able to maintain, thankfully, is the summer internship program and those kinds of things that more and more of those folks are coming to our newsrooms and showing and taking on responsibility for educating senior people. And I'd hate to see that go away, and it's vital.
Andre?
Well, I would tell them exactly the same thing that that we've always told them. That is, number one, get a real education. Don't only study journalism, but study other stuff, because that's the only chance you'll get to study other stuff. But besides that, I think the future is very bright, because whatever the problems we might have in the newspaper industry, the written word is still extremely powerful. And people read a lot still, and they want to read. Another thing we found in our focus groups. And young people read. They read differently, maybe, but they still read. So the written word will keep its very precious and unique influence, whatever the platforms become. And I think that's great for young journalists.
I would encourage them to learn how to count.
Numeracy.
Numeracy is good and often missing. And particularly, we need far more people with an understanding of data and how to use data cleverly and apply that to journalism, as well as to knowing how to market that journalism. So I think there's big opportunities, but it's different skills. People need to learn how to shoot video.
The career path has been disrupted as much as the industry has, but there are you know, I think there are lots of opportunities and very interesting ones, and a requirement for, you know, a fascinating, you know, package of skills. But, you know, anybody starting up in any new job, it's always better to have been born wealthy.
Right? Well, there's your advice. Pick rich parents.
Well,
on that note, it's time we can start getting questions. The microphone is back there. Because this is being live streamed and broadcast, we do ask that everyone go back there. A reminder, a question is something that ends with a question mark. It is not something that ends with a period after a lengthy exposition. Yes, ma'am.
I tweeted my question, too, so you can ignore it when you get the tweet. I'm Alex. I work for Global News. I once worked at the Star, so I know some of you. My question is, I'm one of those young people who never pays for paywalls, and, you know, I work for a TV station, I don't even have cable. But I'm something that I find interesting and I think my generation would actually go for is Netflix. As you know, Netflix is growing, and things like Next Issue, which is just going in right now with magazines, I think actually have potential to, I'd be willing to pay for that. I'm wondering if you have thought about that for a newspaper model and whether that's something you would consider working together, you know, for one subscription fee, you can actually get access to 10 different newspapers, and maybe people would be willing to do that.
In other words, have you ever considered violating antitrust laws? Is that appealing to any of you?
No, but this is a great time to start.
Her phrasing, not mine. But
I repeat my answer, learn how to count and decide how many times you're going to divide up that pie.
With newspapers in particular,
as simple as that.
Because there's not a lot of people who really want the Ottawa paper and the Vancouver paper and the Calgary paper, that it can be a tougher sell, I think. Mm-hmm. Do we have another? The mic stands empty. Do we have anything from Twitter?
No. You've been unbearably convincing.
Well, then.
I think I might just add one word about how people read today, and especially young people. And that's a challenge for newspapers, is that, and I have two boys, 25 and 26, and I see them, or I saw them before they left the house. They're used to multitasking, and they do it all the time. And it's very difficult when you read a newspaper to do that. So I think in the end, the newspaper may last for years and years and years, but obviously more and more people will be doing multitasking, and they will want to have a platform where they can read the news, read a good column, pick up a nice recipe, chat with someone, look at videos. So it seems pretty clear to me that those mobile platforms are the news platforms of the future.
Yes.
So there was a really good session in the fall of 2009 between Jay Rosen and Andrew Keenan and Matthew Ingram on the future of journalism. And I know that a lot of you, a lot of senior managers, including Mr. Crawley, not to single him out, were in the audience for that. And what lessons can you remember that were floating around in 2009 about the problems facing the news industry and, you know, and possible solutions that actually came true out of that discussion? If you remember it at all, or if you remember just the general issues of 2009, and what did we get wrong in trying to diagnose the industry back then?
To frame it a different way, imagine it's 2009 again, and you know what you've learned over the last 5 years or so. What might you be doing differently?
Well, maybe you familiarize the audience and some of us with what was actually said then.
So I don't remember that.
This is really testing.
Let's broadly just say, a lot of people thought a lot of things 5 years ago. Some of them turned out to be true. Some of them turned out to be untrue. If you could go back in time and speak to your 2009 self.
What we found is that the money we invested in the internet, in having a great news site in the internet, it was costly, you know, and certainly, and it did not bring revenues. So I think 5 years ago, maybe a bit longer than 5 years ago, we strongly believed that advertisers would leave the paper and go on the internet on our news sites because our news sites were so popular. But in fact, they left the newspaper but went elsewhere. We lost them. So we then had two news organizations, one for the web, one for the newspaper, more costs and less revenue. So we were wrong.
2009, we were coming out of the worst recession in anybody's memory, and all you could think of was survival. It's a bit better than that now, but some of the principles that have been applied have proved to be the right ones, in my view. The New York Times, finally following the example of the Wall Street Journal and charging for content, was a very important step forward. The FT doing the same thing. So in my view, they have started to prove that people will pay decent money for decent content. Decent content.
Some people will, at least.
Business.
A fraction of the overall audience, but some people.
Enough people.
Yeah.
Enough people. But they won't pay for crap. And they won't pay for most of the stuff that passes for content in most of the US newspapers.
Oh, well. All right. We have a question from Twitter. This is from Karen Ho. With all the layoffs and job freezes, how do you plan on training and bringing in new young talent to produce the content you need for the future? A couple of the news organizations represented here had layoffs just last week, and I know at the National Post, the social media editor was one of the layoffs, and I know there was lots of discussion about, you talked about saving the summer internship program, but do you feel that, is there enough training in bringing up the younger journalists?
It's a very good question, and I think the ambitions we have for the Post Media papers, particularly the Citizen, has required some very fundamental rethinking of newsroom structure and some hard decisions around how we're going to do differentiated content by platform. For example, we've got to a place with our metro newsrooms where we've asked them to build what we describe as a super city desk, that they focus intensely on local content and local content creation only. We've taken out production work and centralized it. We've made that same decision around national and international content so that as we try and take the path towards doing what we do best in those local markets, which is local content, we try to take out as much work as we can that is, I don't like the term, but commodity work and commodity content, centralize it. Is that the best way? I don't know. I think it's the reality of the business has forced us in that direction, and we're very confident that does free up the resources, enough resources to meet the ambitions we have around our four platform strategy.
We have a number of people lined up now.
Just on that point, though, I mean, one thing that I think does have to be acknowledged is that these companies here and other media companies in this country have spent hundreds of millions of dollars in capital urging some members of their newsroom to early retirement and then brought new people in. There has been a commitment to refresh and it's
I'm sure the people in early retirement love that commitment to refresh. That's
well, it's it. In many cases, I think in overwhelming majority of those cases, it has been by choice through voluntary severance programs, it has been something that's been very important to the journalism in Canada, and the fact we've been able to introduce a new cohort of journalists.
Great. Yes, ma'am.
Hello, my name is Tara Kitts. I'm a reader. I just wanted to mention, I see a big trend, and I have seen this for a while, and things going retro. Mad Men. People love the retro things, bars and mini bars in the office and whatnot. And also a huge increase in cafe culture around the world. I think of Paris and the chairs all lined up, forward facing, watching the world. And of course in Paris and even here, people taking a moment to really enjoy their print newspaper. And of course, now you look at a Starbucks and everyone's looking for an outlet to plug in their device. I love it when I see someone, by the way, just reading a traditional newspaper. But I'm just wondering how the newspapers have embraced the cafe culture, if that's something that you're looking at, if you're looking at embracing that cafe culture with print or with, you know, your tablets, and what you think of that.
Don't think you're going to make any money out of selling papers in coffee shops. I do it with Starbucks. Most people don't pay. They should, but they don't. The people behind the counter are not interested in collecting the money. Not their job. They're busy making coffee. So we put it there for marketing reasons. It doesn't make any money. So if I'm in the business of making money, don't go there.
But newspapers originated in coffee shops. You know, I mean, that's where Addison and Steele were doing their first work. They've grown up together. So yeah, I think we embraced cafe culture in the 18th century.
And we've embraced it at the Windsor Star. There is a news cafe in the relocation of the Windsor Star in its downtown location. It's intended to not only be, you know, create the cafe culture, but also be an event hosting facility so that news can happen there. We're going to do the same at our new location at 365 Bloor. I think there is something to it. I think there is something in terms of drawing a different audience in, and you can get a coffee and a sandwich all the time.
If you're interested in an interesting experiment on that, Google the long good read, which probably isn't going to be a business, but something that Guardian's experimenting with right now. Yes.
I wondered if the four of you, speaking with your experience collectively in paywalls, could speak a little more specifically to how the outcomes measured against your expectations or your anticipations. If there's anything you think you did wrong, think you did right now from where you thought you were, what you would be at this time.
It's a big question. If we can answer it briefly,
you can answer just part of it if you want.
Yes.
Well, I'll start. I mean, from where we are at Postmedia, in terms of our registrations, we're further ahead than we thought we would be. The all-access bundling has been successful, tricky, and as we relaunch our platforms, we're going to have to go back at it. It's progressing better than we thought it would. Yes.
Any other
short
brief thoughts from anyone?
We are happy with the numbers we've got so far. We study the New York Times experience quite a lot because they've got longer at it than we have, so we watch them as they cope with the issue. As you said before, it's beginning to plateau, but it's still growing. 2.5 years in, or nearly 3 years in, they're still achieving growth on their subscriptions quarter by quarter.
Right.
That's not bad. And there's other things they can still do, and they are,
as we'll find out,
slicing and dicing their content to sell individual bits. We'll see how that works. So this is still quite a new process. But so far, I like the money. I like the engagement. I like the involvement.
You'd rather have the money than not have the money, yes.
Right. Hi. I have my question sort of as a journalist / closeted academic. And it's sort of in reference to something Mr. Cruickshank brought up about the role of the media in democracy. And I'm thinking, using the sort of model that you're talking about of working towards niches as opposed to speaking to broader audiences, how do you see the media's role changing in terms of its agenda setting function vis-a-vis where it was and where it is potentially in the future, where you're working towards a model where you're trying to, you know, get as many eyeballs as you can and trying to create, you know, interesting headlines and stories that people would want to click on?
I'll say one thing related to that, that the agenda setting function, I think a large part of it has shifted to social media in the sense that news organizations can produce content and it often will have effect, but in many cases it's what gets amplified and picked up that leads to some elected official suddenly having to change his or her mind on an issue or something because things get picked up. So there's a portion at least of that agenda setting has shifted to a more diffuse crowd online. I don't know if anyone else has any other.
Well, I think the only other point I'd make is that regardless of which niche you pursue, I think it is the investigative attitude is enormously important because what social media picks up is what news has been broken. I think that's tended to get seen and put all into one watchdog bucket. And I don't think investigative we shouldn't think of it as being restricted to that. I think investigative reporting can be very, very important across a whole bunch of social functions. I think it has been, and we're probably only going to fully acknowledge it if we lose it. But I don't think that we need necessarily lose that through success in success in niches, which you know, may simply be the newspaper taken apart.
But whatever the disruption in the news media, I mean, if I take for the province of Quebec, there has never been as much investigative journalism than in the last 5 years. Television and newspapers, everyone has now its investigative team, and investigative journalism never has had as much impact in Quebec as it has had in the last two, 3 years. So I think whatever we discuss, platforms and revenues and so on, the news will remain the news, and a good column will remain a good column, and a good analysis will remain a good analysis. You just add tools to make it even better, but in the end, it's the same thing. It's getting a good story.
But we're not doing it all for eyeballs. I mean, you know, the Arctic project that we published last Saturday isn't going to get the kind of traffic that Rob Ford gets on an average day. But we think it's an important subject to put on the table and engage people in debate about. And that debate will go on potentially for weeks. Running lots of pieces about the dangers of transporting oil on tankers. Not going to get fantastic traffic, but it's a very important subject, and I think people care about that.
I do want to get to everyone up there, but there's one question from Twitter I wanted to throw out there, which actually your mention of the Arctic project reminded me of it. It's from Michael Lockhart. What's the consensus surrounding the role of sponsored or branded content within your papers? I know the Globe in particular considers that a significant part of the business, and I know that GE has branding attached to those stories. And we only have 5 minutes left, so it's hard to have a discussion about branded content, native advertising, but any thoughts about boundaries?
GE puts money towards and helped us effectively to pay for that project. I mean, we made money out of print and digital advertising. So they weren't paying our bills, but the ads that you saw on embedded in Ian Brown's long, brilliantly written piece weren't intrusive or popping up and getting in the way or anything like that. They were well used. And we don't call that native advertising. It's ads in context.
Sure. So in that case, was that GE approaching you? Was that you approaching GE?
They were looking for any theme around innovation and exploration.
As GE does in a lot of places.
Yeah, so we go to them and say, we've got a very big project coming, you might be interested in this.
Okay. Any other brief thoughts on
just quickly, there's money there, there's lots of money there. It's about the transparency that's attached to it. It's certainly growing inside Post Media. With what we call the 3i team that exists in Toronto is rolling out to other markets. That involves advertising, marketing, and senior editorial input on any initiative around sponsored content.
All right. Yes.
Hello. So I work at a startup. I'm a journalist, and I went to a talk earlier this year about just a similar theme. And one of the things that came up was selling data. News organizations produce a large amount of data. And you already use it in certain ways to, you know, sell ads to advertisers. So would you consider selling that raw data? And what would be the ethics behind that?
Are you thinking specifically of reader data, or are you thinking of...
Yeah, like your audience. Like, you've got people on your websites, you've got people on your tablets,
as mobile. Magazines have done for some time.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be a huge subject, I think, coming this year, because of, you've got Privacy Commissioner here weighing in. You've got challenges to Google's use of data. This subject's going to get hotter and heavier, and I think we all take a huge risk if we take liberties with the data and don't be, if we're not transparent with our customers. So if they're aware and they're okay, fine. But if you're doing it, not saying it, I think you're in real trouble. Because you won't get forgiven. Certainly our readers will say, you've broken our trust. No. We didn't expect that of you. You should have behaved better. Correct. And they will not be forgiving.
Any other thoughts? Good. Great. Oh, you're not in line. I'm sorry. You're standing right next to there. Sorry. Well, let me ask one last question because we are about out of time. One thing that is distinctive about the Canadian context versus the American context is the role of the CBC and Radio Canada, as you mentioned, in Quebec. I know in the UK, the local media has had a series of discussions slash arguments slash lobbying efforts to limit the amount of work that the BBC can do in local media because they want to protect their territory. And certainly having a free alternative that is government subsidized certainly provides a market challenge in some ways. I'm curious how, if you think that the story of Canadian online media and the online media business would be rolling out differently if the CBC wasn't in the role that it is.
Well, it certainly would have made a difference for us, I think, because many of our readers are also customers of Radio-Canada's news. And of course, all that Radio-Canada does is free. Their websites are free, obviously. So it certainly weighs a lot when we considered, having some kind of paywall or whatever.
So you might have been more willing to have a paywall in charge if you didn't have the free alternative.
Possibly,
there.
But obviously we knew that our readers, people who like us, also are great consumers of Radio-Canada's products, sure. Which will remain free. So,
I know. Feelings hardened in certain corners of post media when the Calgary Herald went to a paywall and CBC thought it was a news story worth telling. I object to the notion that the CBC is free. They have the best paywall in the country, and I can't opt out of it through my taxes. So I think the tenor of the conversation would be quite different.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me interesting, though, that the notion is that if CBC wasn't there, it would be easier for us to go behind paywalls and charge folks more for news. We'd have them prisoner. that sounds like a great reason to have the CBC, among many other great reasons to have the CBC.
Sure. We have in the United States National Public Radio Station. It's obviously not the same, but
no.
It's a significant. There are plenty of NPR stations who are readily excited for when the local paper puts up a paywall because then they can try to snare some of that audience.
Well, there's an enormous public value in having universal access
sure.
to breaking news, and in Canada there are special requirements for that. I think CBC has played that role wonderfully over many years.
All right, well, I think we are out of time, so Natalie, would you like to?
Good evening, bonsoir. I'm Natalie Turvey, Executive Director of the Canadian Journalism Foundation. This is the second time Josh Benton has been kind enough to join us in Toronto in coldest January. So, Josh, I always January. I want to thank you for the work you put into making this a lively and substantive discussion. Thank you so much. And our thanks to our panel, John Cruikshank, Philip Crawley, Andre Pratt, and Jerry Knott for your insight into the new business mix and meeting readership and audience and advertiser demands in a disruptive media landscape. Thank you so much to our panel. Coming up in the JTalk series on February 27th, we're joined by Vice Media co-founder Sarush Alvi to talk about Vice's journey from Montreal Magazine to New York-based media conglomerate. We'll explore Vice's unique approach to covering conflict zones and their plans to invest $50 million in their news operation over the next 3 years. On May 1st, Steve Ladarante will join us, the newly appointed manager of news and government partnerships with Twitter, to talk about Twitter's work with news organizations in Canada, and we'll have an introduction from Kirsten Stewart. And on June 4th, save the date for the CJF Annual Awards, our celebration of Canadian journalistic excellence. We're excited to be launching several new awards and fellowships this year. In partnership with the Canadian Women's Foundation, we'll recognize a journalist who's shedding light on women's equality in Canada. We're introducing a training fellowship for an early career Aboriginal journalist. And we're launching a new series of awards, News Gems, recognizing the journalists behind the excellent Enterprise and investigative journalism in Canada over the past year. Follow us on Twitter at CJFFJC for updates on our winners and our nominees. And it's not too late to get your nominations in for the CJF Lifetime Achievement Award, Le Prix Couronnement de Carrière. The award recognizes a Canadian journalist who's made an outstanding lifetime contribution to journalism in Canada. Nous encourageons les candidatures de tous les types de médias et en provenance de toutes les sphères du journalisme. The deadline for the award is January 30th, and nominations are open on the CJF website. I'd now like to invite you, along with our guests in the studio next door, to join us for cocktails and more conversation at the back of the room. Un grand merci à nos commanditaires et nos collaborateurs, and thank you for being here tonight and supporting the work of the CJF.